Hello and welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Bowring. Today's show is an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving art scene and the people that make it happen. Every Friday at 12:30, we'll sit down at a Richmond cafe and have lunch with one of these people. The conversation is live and spontaneous, so pull up a chair and meet someone fascinating. Today we're talking with Mary Flynn. Mary is the senior editor of Blackbird and has been the director of the New Virginia Review since 1985. She is the editor with George Garrett of Elvis in Oz, new writing from Hollins College, creative writing program, and she's also facilitated the editing of The Gazer Within by Larry Levis. And finally, but certainly not least, she was the first recipient of the Teresa Pollock Award for Words presented by Richmond Magazine. Mary, welcome to Zero Hour, and thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
I think we're going to talk about two different things here. The first one is the New Virginia Review. For those who know nothing about it, tell me a little bit about that.
All right. The New Virginia Review is, at this stage in its existence, an umbrella organization that partners with other groups or organizations or entities to do programs related to contemporary writing.
Who do you guys partner with?
All right. We partner most significantly with the creative writing program at Virginia Commonwealth University. To publish Blackbird, an online journal of literature and the arts, www.blackbird.vcu.edu.
Okay.
And we also partner with the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts to produce Poetic Principles, which is a reading series that runs out of the museum, and usually that features about five writers a year. And then we partner with a group of community volunteers to produce Go Read, which is Richmond's One City, One Book program. So that's what New Virginia Review does. And as a part of that, I also coordinate the Poetic Principles series, work as a volunteer, or work as a with book selection primarily, and deal with the writerly part of Go Read, and am a senior editor of Blackbird. Is a
okay.
Small
well, here,
literary
let me...
arts organization that works in partnerships.
All right. So essentially, you've got the New Virginia Review, and part of that is Go Read, right?
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is Blackbird.
Mm-hmm.
Did I miss a piece?
Poetic Principles.
Ah, right. Okay.
And the major parts that I work with are Blackbird and Poetic Principles.
Okay. Well, let's talk about Blackbird.
Been really fun this fall.
Tell people again where they can, how they can access Blackbird.
All right, Blackbird is at www.blackbird.vcu.edu.
Okay, great.
And if you Google Blackbird, we come up right after a large bar in, I think, Oregon that we figure must do online dating.
You come up after a large bar?
Yeah, there's a bar, and I think. I can't remember where, on the
right.
Either Washington or Oregon, that apparently has many, many visitors online.
So.
But since you can't drink at it online, we figure they're doing something else.
Right, okay. So tell me about Blackbird.
It began as a germ of an idea that Michael Keller, who's one of our online editors, and I started talking about some years ago when the print version of New Virginia Review was becoming really too difficult to do by myself for the lack of bang that you get for your buck in the number of copies you can put in the hands of people for them to be able to read the material that you publish. And at that time, I noticed that Plowshares, which is a first-rate literary journal published by Emerson College in Boston, had decided to put all of its content online and make it available.
When was this?
This was about 2000, I guess.
Okay. Right.
And Don Lee, who's the editor of Plowshares, has always struck me as being a very far-sighted, very smart guy, not only about the material he puts into Plowshares, mm-hmm. but also about how he judges how the literary marketplace is evolving. And once he did that, I thought, well, this must be the place to go find readers. And right. so we went in through a number of discussions with the English department at VCU, and then with in 2000, and how many times have, how long have we been up? This is 2006. I think we went live in the spring of 2002, but right. I'll have to double okay. check that for you. And with Greg Donovan and uh-huh. William Tester.
Greg Donovan is a professor of yes. poetry and, at, I guess, writing down at VCU.
At VCU.
And Greg Tester.
And William Tester, who was then in the teaching fiction there as the mm-hmm. three literary editors, and Michael okay. Keller and Jeff Lodge as the technology editors, the mm-hmm. online editors. And since then, Bill Tester has left Richmond, so Greg and I do all of the literary editing. And this fall, Jeff Lodge went to take a job with VCU in Doha. So we're a leg on our stool
Doha
short at the
Qatar?
Moment. Yes, Doha okay. Qatar is a part of the VCU School of
really?
Design.
For those of you who don't know, that really, it's not located in New Jersey.
Nope.
What is it butted up against over there? Is it face the Red Sea? Does it?
They're a little spot down there.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
the VCU has this extremely successful design school there that's
right.
sponsored by the emir and the emir's wife. Mm-hmm. And they also
anyway,
teach
it's in
English.
In the Middle East, we
it's
can say that.
It's in the Middle East.
Yes.
And they teach English. So,
so they have the design school, and they're teaching English, and they're teaching it, I think, only to women. Is that right? Is it
At
just
the
a
moment,
women's,
it's just a women.
Just a women's college. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah,
and,
fascinating.
And Jeff saw an opportunity that he couldn't turn down.
Right.
The literary marketplace, shall we say, in the nonprofit sector is not where you would go to make your fortune.
Right. What prompted you to do this? Why did you? I mean, you're obviously a smart, capable human being. And I think knowing going into something like this, there were going to be financial limitations.
It makes you creative.
That's
where our partnerships come from, is trying to make the dollars that people are kind enough and generous enough to give to literature through mm-hmm. me go as far as they possibly could.
But I mean, for you personally, why did you?
Oh, because I'm a fool for love.
What do you mean?
No, I love literature and the people who
okay.
make it. So
okay.
it,
right.
it gives
so
me
a...
great pleasure to,
yeah.
to find good stuff and put it out where people can read it. And I fell into the hands of Louis D. Rubin, Jr. as a freshman at Hollins College uh-huh. back in 1965. And he's one of the major figures in Southern literature scholarship and in helping to develop great new writers.
Right.
He was the founder of Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. And so I became one of Lewis's girls, and which is a pretty neat group. It
yeah,
includes Lee
great.
Smith and Annie Dillard and uh-huh. Jane Gentry and Lucinda McKeithen. And they're just a wonderful group of women. And then I also was lucky enough to be at Hollins with Richard Dillard and George Garrett. And so I was introduced to an exciting creative community, and that made my mind just come to life, and it's much more fun to be a little short of the rent money
yeah.
and have a mind and have things that are always interesting to do.
Right.
Than to my mind, anyway. That's why
interesting
I am a
choice.
Fool for love.
Was it a hard choice?
No, it
no?
sort of grew that
really?
Way.
Really? I mean, it was easy to just sort of follow your
I
passion?
I had no idea how to get a job either. This being back when ladies
right.
from a certain area got
right.
married and then,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
took care of the house.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it sort of presented itself, but it also, I found
But you had enough
to
courage to you had enough courage to follow your passion.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
you found a passion and
What's
you followed
What's the point
it?
Of working all of your life? It's
yeah.
something that doesn't reward you deeply in,
yeah.
in some way.
I think
way
a lot
that,
of us get stuck in that, though,
mm-hmm.
you know? I mean, one of the things I talk to people about, you know, about who are involved in the arts is there really is a certain amount of, I think, courage involved in making that decision and following that path. Because certainly in this culture, you know, there's very little government support, if any. And, you know, what? 0.33111 something percent, some ridiculous number, ever end up, you know, really making a really good living and making the arts or being involved in the arts. So,
no, but it means you have a handhold on something that has a chance to outlast you too,
yeah.
Which is one of the remarkable things about good literature. It's how we travel in time back to other places and into other minds and hearts.
How do you see your role in this? I mean, are you writing yourself?
No. What I see my role is trying to find the people who are doing that, who are beginning or in the middle or at the end of careers as poets or fiction writers or essayists or whatever, and to help them keep or build an audience, to make sure that their names don't drop out of the place where they can be found and read. Taking Larry Levis as an example.
Yeah, give me an example.
Who was a wonderful poet who was here in Richmond and died 10 years ago. He's one of the most significant poets of our generation.
Really?
He speaks for us, I think, in ways that are remarkable, true, exciting, and even funny from time to time. And being able to try to keep his work in front of people is something I feel is an important thing that as a literary magazine editor that I do. So every fall, we do something called our Levis Reading Loop, where we will revisit something by Larry.
Mm-hmm.
We have some audio of readings that he did and a little bit of video. We'll find someone who's written something about him that treats some aspect of his work, whether it's a single poem or something more than that. And that is a little something that reminds people that this was a brilliant man who wrote about our place and time.
Why is it so important? I mean, I'm assuming there are people listening who had bad experiences with poetry in school where they had to analyze it or,
figure out
the hidden meaning. I mean, why should people pay attention to poetry?
What do you know about ancient Greece?
What do I know about it? Have you got 30 seconds?
Okay. Yeah, but I mean, have you heard of the Trojan War?
Sure.
Do you know that story?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know about Achilles' jealousy and heartbreak?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know about Priam's loss of his son, son Hector?
No.
I mean,
did Priam lose his son Hector?
Yes, Priam lost his son Hector. Hector was killed in the Trojan War. But you remember the line in Hamlet where it talks about what am I to Hecuba or Hecuba to me?
Right.
But the way we know those stories, the way we have any sort of a connection with people across these thousands of years is by the literature that has come down that has told us something about what they felt and who they were.
Right.
And you can do that have it had an Oedipus complex lately, you know, little things
right.
like that. And so the writers, there will be some writers today who tell our story in 2,000 years.
Right.
And if you don't nurture them and feed them and tend their gardens, then you have a bigger chance of losing who they are. And I firmly believe Larry's one of the people who tells what it was to be in the 60s in this country and to be a young person dealing with that dislocation and fractured sort of nature of the world. And also somebody who tells us what it was like to be in the Valley of California when it was in the middle of tremendous change.
Mm-hmm.
From a certain kind of agriculture to a mono sort of agriculture and agricultural business. And that sort of then tells that American story of a tie to earth, to the ground, and to working the ground, and to valuing the kinds of people who do that work.
Why do you think more people aren't drawn into poetry? Do you think it's an educational problem?
I think it's an educational problem to a large extent. I think people ask them to read The Wasteland when they're 16 years old and then ask them at the end of it, what does this mean? and that can puzzle a lot of folks.
that's very well said.
And on the other hand, you should sit down with a poem, any poem, and read it like you listen to music. You should let it just wash over you, and its meaning will make itself clear to you over time. or will say it will come, something will come that you can either articulate or not over
or
time.
Or not, yeah.
And because all poetry, you don't have to be able to articulate what you get from it any more than you articulate what you get from a painting or a piece of music. You're fooled because it's in words that you ought to be able to say, this is X,
yeah,
Y, Z.
Right. Read it and go, okay, got it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, sometimes when I read poems, I'll read it and you know, like pick up the New Yorker and I'll read it and I'll just read the poem and I'll go, what in the world? What do I do at that point?
You sit with that poem. You go, okay, I'll read it, and just sort of read it out loud.
I mean, it makes I don't know about other people, but you know, sometimes it makes me feel stupid.
No, that's
do you know
the
what
problem.
I mean?
And poets are not generally out there to make you feel stupid.
Yeah.
They're out there to do a lot of different things.
Uh-huh.
Some of them are just playing with language.
Mm-hmm.
But probably the best thing to do with a poem is to read it out loud.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. I mean, poetry is metrical language.
Uh-huh.
It has a rhythm, and that rhythm and how the words bump up against each other as far as sound is concerned is an important part of what the poem is doing.
Right.
Now, our earliest religious responses were poetic. I mean, that's where a lot of it comes from. I'm thinking of more modern things, but medieval chants.
Okay.
No, lot are even Buddhist chants. I mean, that's a rhythmic language that is supposed to take you somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I was studying Buddhism, one of the first things I learned was, "Oh, money, pay me whom."
Mm-hmm.
And the guy that I was studying with, you know, I said, "What does it mean?" And he just smiled and looked at me. And he wasn't going to, you know, I mean, it's Sanskrit and it does have a particular meaning. But he looked at me and said, "That's really not important."
Mm-hmm.
just say it. And what did happen for me before I found out what it meant was it developed a melody, a feeling, a whole sense to it that, you know.
Well, if you work a poem sort of the same way, that will come,
mm-hmm.
particularly if the poet is doing his or her job, which is trying to give you some markers of how to get there. Like Larry's poems, the language in them is incredibly rich, and they're usually quite beautiful. I don't have one here.
When you say the language is rich, what do you mean by that?
There are some poets who you would call plain speakers, almost like the Society of Friends. By comparison to that, Larry's much more Baroque and Catholic in his vocabulary and in the sweep of a metaphor that he's willing to take on and then let it sail way out to the edge of something before he'll turn and bring it back for you. And they're marvelous that way.
Uh-huh.
And they will break your heart when you read them, but you go back to them a lot, and they open something else every time. And poets, I think, would like you to give them a chance and just sort of go with a blank slate.
Right.
Sit down, read it out loud in a quiet space. The next day, maybe read it out loud to yourself again.
Has it changed your life?
Oh, I mean, how to say anything changes your life? It's helped me to articulate my life and the time I live in, and to put words to, or to feelings that I couldn't put a finger on, to put words to the way a day makes you feel when the sun is absolutely gorgeous and the sky is brilliant blue. And you don't know how to package that or tell people about it.
What is that? How do you,
Larry makes a remark in that essay, "The Gazer Within," to something to the effect that ecstasy is a part of our birthright as human beings, and poetry is frequently one of the ways that we can go into or articulate or understand that ecstasy, which means being outside of ourselves and a part of something else.
Right.
And in that sense, it is life changing in that it helps you to give form to things that you can't necessarily express, and in the sense that if you care about being able to look at the life and the time you're in without necessarily just watching them go by, that you want to be engaged in it to some degree, to be aware of what you're in, then poetry is one of the tools to help you articulate that or get to it in some way. And it also makes you feel less lonely. Yeah. I mean, these guys write these things, and, you know, it's like a handshake across the distance. You know, it's okay, we're all in this kind
we're
of
all
together.
In this thing
I've been there too, you know.
Right.
And or I've gone here, you want to see, you know, which is what fiction does wonderfully. You can live so many lives in so many places. And but poetry tends to not be quite as absolutely narrative as fiction, so it's a little harder to follow and therefore sometimes becomes more personal. But in Larry's poem Caravaggio, Swirl and Vortex, one of the things that happens is he visits the Vietnam Memorial and sees the name of an old friend of his there. And one of the lines in the poem, as he's standing next to somebody, says, "It's all right to cry here." And what that poem says, it's all right to mourn to a degree this world that we were a part of, if you were that 60s generation that saw that war and those things happen. And poems frequently can help us grieve. And a lot of Larry's later poems were elegies, which are about dealing with different kinds of grief.
Is he the most interesting?
Much more abstract.
He the most interesting poet you've met, think? Or?
Oh, I've been lucky to meet so many that
really?
It would be hard to say.
Really?
I mean, Ellen Bryant Voigt, Philip Levine, Dave Smith, Charles Wright, George Garrett, Richard Dillard, Margaret Gibson. I just couldn't really put a finger. They're all that I've just been way too lucky.
Yeah. Are they? Do you find that they're apart from the general crowd of people? I mean, do you find them? I don't know how to put this. I don't know. More tuned in. More aware when they're doing their work. Yeah.
I think most poets are just folks like you and me.
Right.
But which means we all have our blind spots.
Right.
And what poets do, Dave Smith has a quotation in a recent essay called "No Threat, No Poem." And there are people and Terry Hummer, who was here in town for a good while, said that a poem needs to be dangerous.
What does that mean?
And I think it means that when you're writing it, when you're reading it, you do take on bigger questions than you necessarily.
Okay.
You know, it defies your comfort.
So it's a search.
It defies your comfort to a degree.
So
it wants to say, hey, you're sitting there, you know, cozy. Let's think outside the cozy a little bit.
Right. So you're not just. Talk about that a little more. I mean, what do you think poets are doing when they're writing? What are they?
You said they're
getting outside of their. They're trying to learn.
I don't know. I mean, any creative process has a little mystery in it.
Yeah.
And Larry always said that you needed to write with a pen with a gold nib because the muse liked to live in a gold nib, and they liked gold, and they would come. And I think the reason there was a creative presence called the muse is because there is something that comes in.
There is a mystery.
There is a mystery to it.
Yeah, there is a tuning into almost, you know, Jungian larger self, you know, unconscious something, tapping into something larger.
I think a lot of the poets, I would say, I know would say, oh, yeah, let's stay away from all that.
Right,
you know, sort of out there in the ozone talk. I think Phil Levine would probably go, bull.
Yeah,
you know,
really.
Whatever. But
it's a lot of damn hard work, is what it is.
It is a lot of hard work.
Yeah.
If you look at the drafts that somebody like William Butler Yeats made of poem after poem after poem after poem, I was just hearing a talk by Claudia Emerson, who won the Pulitzer for a book called Late Wife last spring. And she says, you know, 15 drafts right off the bat is, you know, common for her.
Really?
And it is work.
Yeah,
I mean, I think it's work that most of the poets I know feel privileged to be able to do, but it is work. You might get the germ of something right in the first pass, but once that germ is there, then you have to tweak it into art. It doesn't just become art by coming out of your mind and onto a piece of paper.
If someone is interested in poetry but sort of afraid of it, right? Mm-hmm. Where would you tell them to start? Are there poets that are more accessible?
I would tell them to start with a wonderful book by Edward Hirsch called How to Read a Poem and Fall in Love with Poetry.
Really?
And
Edward Hirsch, Edward How to Read
Hirsch
a Poem?
And Fall in Love with Poetry.
Okay.
And what Ed does in that book is sort of take you by the hand and say, hey, we can do this.
Right.
Exactly. And right. He presents, he has a wonderfully eclectic taste that goes in many directions. And he's really good at showing you from a poet's point of view how it is to sit and read a poem. And one of the first things he says is to sit in a quiet room and read it to yourself and then read it out loud.
Right.
So that's somewhere here, just to start.
Well, let's talk. I mean, this has been wonderful.
We we